and welcome to Against the Law, the misconception-busting podcast that aims to take commonly held mistruths about the ancient world and cancel them on Twitter. We asked you, our listeners, to tell us about the conspiracies and misconceptions you think are the biggest offenders when it comes to ancient history. The Against the Law gavel, which usually sounds when we come across a historical mix-up, will no doubt be ground into sawdust by the end of the episode. It definitely gave us food for thought, so we thought we'd hop onto the mic and give our hot takes on your hot topics. Joining me in the studio today are our usual crew. We've got Xenia, our resident Tweety Bird and poster of various Twitter polls, here to clear things up about the ancient Romans. We've got Meg here too, TikTok star and social media guru, to examine the results of said poll and share her thoughts on the ancient Greek myths and legends. Barney's here and he's ready to retweet the most horrible ancient misunderstandings, bringing his knowledge about the ancient Near East to the table. I'm Flo and I'm an absolute twit for Twitter, but I'm not an ancient history expert. Oh no, I'm the equivalent of a clueless keyboard warrior when it comes to the past, but here I am to learn from you and with you, dear listener, about your Against the Laws. So we've had a bit of a response from people who've got their sort of peeves about what's been said about the ancient world, true or not. One comment from Sian is just the word aliens, which I think we covered off a little bit in our last episode on conspiracies. I'm going to give the team a comment and I would love your thoughts as to whether or not you think it's a misconception or a conspiracy. Okay, so are we ready?
Yeah.
Ready.
Groovy. Okay, so Chris has said that the ancient world was Northern European white. So I'd be interested in people's opinions on that, whether or not this is true.
No.
No. Like, just look at a map, guys. Bonnie, do you want to start with your area? Because, like, that's where it all came from and that's, like, the furthest east.
Yeah, we can sort of track forward from there, right?
Groovy.
So I guess it's worth pointing out at the top that even our podcast is selective in the sort of breadth of history and geography that it covers, right? Because we talk about generally the Mediterranean mostly, or Mediterranean adjacent parts of the ancient world. But of course, there's plenty of stuff going on in the Americas, sub-Saharan Africa, Eastern Asia, and Oceania at various times in history. But yeah. What we cover and what Europe sort of identifies as its heritage doesn't just include Northern Europe, but it also includes North Africa and the most part of the Middle East as well, especially when thinking about biblical history. And, you know, they do call Mesopotamia the cradle of civilization. And as far back as the Neolithic, it's the sort of package of agriculture and farming that comes out of what is today the Middle East and spreads all the way across Europe, eventually ending up as far west as Spain and the British Isles. So yeah, absolutely not. History is not just Northern Europe. And it's the pure ancientness of Mesopotamia that always attracted me to it. Urbanism is kicking off there, you know, like 6,000 years ago, the so-called Uruk period. And the city of Uruk itself has tens of thousands of people in like 3000 BC. It's just incredibly ancient. And then we sort of roll on from there with the big major empires of the ancient Near East for the next few thousand years. And they eventually get rolled over by Alexander. So you've got thousands of years of history in the Near East and Egypt before Greece and Rome even start to catch up.
Yeah, fighting talk.
So if we move then forwards to, I'm going to throw it over to Meg. Meg, Greece, Northern European white, what's going on?
I mean, Greece is in Europe. I feel that's true. But I'm going to just like immediately go 180 again. What are we talking about when we say Greece? Ancient Greece was not like one thing, and there were many, many, many different like cultures and people within what we describe as ancient Greece. So even the idea of saying you could call ancient Greece one kind of, what's the word, like united concept, and that there were like specific sort of races or cultures attached to that, is just like built on a flawed assumption anyway. So immediate against the law there.
The gavel's going to be going off the chain today. Gavel everywhere.
Guys, we're going to need a bigger gavel for this. Come on.
Misconceptions 2. We're going to need a bigger gavel.
Misconceptions 2, Northern European white boogaloo.
No.
So, yeah, again, like Meg said, Italy, where like Rome and the Roman Empire sort of grew out of, that is in Europe. Is it in Northern Europe? Not really. it's in Europe, it's the Mediterranean. The, like, the word Mediterranean means the middle of the world, media terra. So that shows you what the Romans thought of themselves. In that they, in fact, they called it Mare Nostrum, our sea. It was all theirs. But the Roman Empire, of course, spanned Mediterranean Europe, North Africa, the Middle East, and bits of Northern Europe. But it wasn't primarily Northern Europe. It was primarily the Mediterranean. Like, as I said at the beginning, just like, guys, look at a map. I think this misperception, I think it has quite a long and very convoluted history that's kind of got layered and layered and layered up into suddenly people thinking that people in the ancient world looked different and were literally like came from different places than they actually did. One factor has to do with power, I think. So the Roman Empire is kind of held up as, throughout history, it's been held up as like a model empire. And don't get me wrong, there were a lot of things wrong with it. That's just like how it's been perceived a lot of the time. So then later empires or later sort of world powers tended to look to the Roman Empire as their model, especially after the Renaissance, when they started getting a lot more of the ancient texts translated, actually from the House of Wisdom in Baghdad, right, Barney? That was kind of where they got their ancient texts back from, because they'd lost it all.
Yes, I love this story. I was hoping we were going to get onto this today. So I think what Xenia is alluding to there is the fact that a lot of classical texts have come down to us in the modern day and in Europe via the Middle East and Andalusia in Spain, in fact. Aristotle and Plato are very good examples. Their works would have been predominantly unknown to us in Europe and lost were it not for Arab translators. And they just called Aristotle the philosopher, which I really like. But yeah, there was a massive break in transmission in Europe because of the Byzantines and their church. They weren't big fans of this pagan philosophy after they converted to Christianity. But the texts were preserved by scholars in Baghdad and later in Andalusia by Islamic and Jewish translators on the hunt for wisdom. And gradually the texts worked their way back into Europe before the Renaissance. So yeah, it's a wonderful story.
So again, this led to sort of people reading them, rereading these ancient texts and trying to read a bit of themselves into it as well. And I think we also, you know, that's one of the attractions of these ancient texts sometimes today even, is when we read it, we can relate to the personalities, to the love stories, to the, you know, incredible myths and legends that are related in these texts. And we feel like we see a bit of ourselves in them because so many sort of personalities and experiences and emotions are repeated throughout history. And that's what makes them so beautiful and timeless. And I think that's one of the responses that it generated in the people then in Northern Europe who read them. But what I also would like to point out is that like the people who read them were under like no illusion that the people who wrote them were from the same country as them. So you get loads of travellers, for example. One of my favourites. A woman called Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, and her husband was the ambassador to Constantinople in the early 1700s. And she loved reading, she loved the classical texts, and she and her husband decided to take the overland route from London to Constantinople. And they're going through these lands that are now part of the, that were then part of the Ottoman Empire, but that of course used to be part of the Roman Empire. Or, you know, Alexander the Great's empire. And she's going through them and she's kind of writing down in her letters and in her diaries, like, oh, look, I saw some line dancing in this little village, and this must have been what so-and-so is describing as like ancient Greek line dancing. This must be the closest thing they had to it. And she's really, really excited to see the places in which the text she loves actually took place. So she was not under no illusion that the classical world was North European white. She was fully aware that she had to go physically to like where that world was, and she fully appreciated that. So I think then this idea of like Northern Europeanness has come actually much later and much more recently. You don't get people who had this kind of first-hand access to the texts thinking that this was the case. So that's quite an unfortunate recent development, I think.
That's so interesting, the way you phrased that. Like, and I think actually that's a massive part of how we just sort of relate to the ancient world. Because like my sort of favourite thing, you know, what I've just like done my research on is translation. And there's that exact same question of like, when you read a translation of, say, an ancient text, do you want to sort of be moved closer to the foreign world and feel like you're in a foreign world? Or do you want the text to be sort of moved closer to your world and you feel really comfortable with it and you sort of know what's going on? And it's, you know, that process of domestication. So that's actually so interesting that you can, that applies like even beyond sort of technical aspects of translation. That's just very much how we relate to like the past as well.
Absolutely. I mean, this annoyance with the concept that there's a misconception that it's Northern European white has been echoed by another person who's commented on the thread, Dr. Kevin. Hello, Dr. Kevin, who has said the greatest misconception is that the ancient world is primarily a European phenomenon. Most of the ancient world is Mesopotamian, North African and Mediterranean. It touches Europe, but it's not rooted in it. So, you know, it's a fairly prevalent misconception that annoys people. So I'm glad that we could get the gavel out for that one. We've got the Ancient History Hound podcast who's commented. Hello, guys. And they've said that the ancient world was a monolithic slab of time with no one within these periods experiencing history. I'm not going to lie, to me, the ancient world before taking part in this podcast did feel a little bit like that. It just felt like an expanse of sort of mild things happening. Do we have any comments about, well, it just, I didn't have a great history education, I have to say, at my secondary school, and I certainly didn't take it any further than that. And it was just, beyond the Vikings and castles in year seven, we didn't really do anything older than that. So it was just a kind of historic, boring wasteland of not much happening. Sorry.
Did you do the Romans at primary school? Because that's my lasting memory, is like dressing up as a Roman and like then you did the Egyptian. But there was no, I think, I mean, secondary school, obviously you do more like sort of medieval and modern stuff. But I think the interesting thing that I remember from primary school is that I had absolutely no concept of the idea that the Romans and the Egyptians could have had any relationship to each other or existed at the same time or existed at very different times. In my mind, that was basically different planets, like Rome, Egypt. And you were learning about them, as if the way you'd learn about like Pluto or whatever.
It felt almost like one civilization replaced the next, and it didn't matter where on the globe they were. It was just the Romans, and then something happened, and then there were probably Vikings and Anglo-Saxons, and then something else happened, and then it's Henry VIII.
Yeah, and all these things are like totally unconnected to each other.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting that children sort of understand or are led to understand these discrete historical units as almost analogous to modern nation states.
Yeah.
Just thinking about the way you phrased it there, Meg, like you've got Egypt packaged, you've got Rome packaged.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, it's not actually a period of history. Yeah.
Actually, I remember I looked a little while ago at the Key Stage 1 and 2 specification for the history curriculum. And I think if I'm correct in remembering, teachers have the opportunity of teaching even very young primary school children about either ancient Egypt, ancient Mesopotamia, ancient China, or the Indus Valley as well as options. But generally, they opt for Egypt, I think, or at least in my experience. But you could have kids as young as 7 or 8 learning about the Sumerians.
That's amazing. Write your name in Akkadian.
So picking up on the point there about this sort of flat expanse of time, I think humans can be forgiven a little bit for struggling to comprehend like the vast depths that are involved here, because really it's thousands and thousands of years that we're talking about with this history. And I think sometimes they do get collapsed into a big mass. You know, humans aren't very good at thinking about millions of stars in space or the water in the sea. And I think the massive antiquity of history is another one.
It really did feel, when I was a child, it really did feel mind-blowing when I learnt things like we're closer to Cleopatra in time than Cleopatra was to the building of the pyramids. Or when I learnt that trade happened between great ancient civilizations, it blew my mind that it was happening concurrently. Or even learning that there were ambassadors from China in ancient Rome and they were trying to wrap their head around the different kind of like ruling system, like a monarchy versus, you know, a senate, and it, every time I learned something like that, I was like, you what, mate?
That the Cleopatra thing, not even the time thing, just that was the thing that actually I remember learning at like some midway through secondary school or something, being like, hang on a minute, Cleopatra is like so involved in the Greek and Roman world. Like she was very, you know, but in my mind, she was like Queen of Egypt, utterly separate, no connections. And I was like, oh no, she knew them.
She was intimately.
Doing that. Intimately knew the Romans.
I love that point on trade there as well, Flo. Because I think sometimes we, and this is just the way that history exists within modern society, but there's a sort of arrogance of the present, right? People think what we have now at the moment is the most complex and the most sophisticated, with this sort of narrative of progress versus the past that we generally have. And we have mass globalization now, for example, but the links between different regions of the ancient world were incredible. For example, the connections between Afghanistan and Egypt and the Mediterranean, or the fact that amber is making its way all the way from Denmark down to Egypt as part of a global trade network is really incredible. But often in people's understanding, these areas are packaged into discrete little units with the belief that they don't have much scope outside of their immediate boundaries for contact.
The first occasion where I noticed or sort of twigged that how underestimated the ancient world is in terms of trade is when I was a kid and first learned about seimeen ware being found in the UK, which is very prevalent in the UK. But the fact that it had to travel so far to get here made me rethink how, you know, because I think there's a misconception that people in the ancient world were sort of slightly advanced Neolithic people, cavemen who bash rocks together and can forge swords and things like that. But actually what you're looking at is a serious amount of trade that's happening. I mean, even at sites like Stonehenge, there's evidence for like tourist shops, ancient tourist shops, where you could come and buy things to offer up at Stonehenge, which to me is nuts because that's the sort of thing that we do now. Like, oh, if you come and grab a souvenir of get one of those really awful quality erasers with Stonehenge printed on it for £2.50. Honestly, the worst kind of erasers that exist. But we do that now. People don't change for a start, like this we know, but also people are far more capable of getting stuff and doing stuff than we give them credit for.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's amazing sometimes when we read about people within the ancient world experiencing that for themselves as well. So the Romans loved doing tourism in ancient Egypt. Like Hadrian went on literally a massive sort of tourist trail up and down the Nile and through Egypt. You know, he's there. He's at the Statue of Memnon, where famously someone on his in his group, Julia Balbilla, graffitied on the Statue of Memnon. But he's there as a tourist. That's a tourist attraction. He went there to do that, which I think is so funny. And then Pausanias, he's a Greek writer, but he lives in the period of the Roman Empire, the 2nd century AD. And he's literally writing a tourist's guide to Greece, so that Romans when I say Romans, I don't necessarily even mean people from Italy. Like Pausanias lived in Rome for a bit, but he was actually from Turkey. He's writing for other people within the Roman world to go as tourists to Greece and to understand what they're seeing. He's talking about these ancient temples and these ancient myths and explaining it to people through his book. I just think that's really cool. Like, I could do with a Pausanias right now.
The Pausanias stuff is so lovely. I think we talked about him before in our travel episode, I think, about like getting to the Olympics and how you get to the Olympics. And there's some like tips about like, oh, well, these roads are a bit dodgy and you will get robbed, but, you know, good luck.
Just in the same way that Xenia has mentioned Hadrian there, I've got a king from Babylonia who was a bit of a historian himself, and probably in similar ways to Xenia having Hadrian, he's also my absolute favourite of all Mesopotamian rulers. He's like my desert island king. I'll take him with me. He's called Nabonidus, and he's the last king of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, which makes him actually the last indigenous ruler of Mesopotamia as well, because the Neo-Babylonian Empire is overtaken by the Persians eventually, and that's then overtaken by Alexander. And so that's the end of sort of autonomous rule of that part of the world for a while in antiquity. So Nabonidus in the 6th century BC basically takes his responsibility as priest-king to restore ancient temples very seriously. And so he ends up going around and trying to find and dedicate new inscriptions at ancient temples that he knows from sources, because he can still read very old cuneiform. And so he finds himself discovering inscriptions and statues of kings as far back as the Akkadian Empire, the first big empire, which is thousands of years before he existed. I think we have around 2300 BC in our minds for the old Akkadian Empire, and Nabonidus is ruling around 550 BC, so almost 2000 years later, yeah. And he's finding these inscriptions and digging them up. People call him the first archaeologist, which is probably a bit grand, because what he was really trying to do was big himself up as king. But I just love him so much. I think all of Mesopotamian history is sort of condensed into this one man. And not only was he a Babylonian king, but he adopted a lot of Akkadian and Assyrian identity as well, which is quite unusual because they were from different periods with different nuances. But he harmonized all of that into one person, into his own historical heritage. So yeah, he was acutely aware not just of his lineage as king, but also of the slightly different empires and ethnic groups that came before him and led to where he was in his own present. So yeah, I think he's wonderful. And completely blows up that myth that the ancients didn't experience history at all.
That's lovely. What a story.
It is rather lovely. Nabonidus, what a legend. Speaking of good people, and Nabonidus being a cool dude by your account, Barney, Greg has commented saying that Alexander the Great was a good man is a misconception that irks Greg. So we all know that people can be great at something but not good people. In the news, we always read about people, famous people who have been accused of this, that and the other, and it's discovered to be true. So we know that people can be great at things, but not good. How do we feel about not just Alexander the Great, but other figures in history, in ancient history, who are considered fondly by people in the present day, who were probably actually kind of just walking turds?
Yeah, that's a great question. or is it a good question? Anyway, I think, actually, to be fair, not to dismiss that person who said that, but I actually think not many people think Alexander the Great was a good man with everyone's best interests at heart. I think he's famous for being a very powerful military leader, and people who are very powerful military leaders aren't often, you know, lovely, fuzzy types who you'd like to get a cup of tea with. He absolutely did horrible things, but the history that's been passed down, the tradition, is that he was great at doing those things, at sort of conquering and ravaging. So I think that's probably maybe the source of that great there isn't a moral judgment, I wouldn't say.
Have we got anyone else in his life? I always think of Hannibal Barker as being quite a cool dude, and he was certainly a great tactician and good at what he did, but he probably also wasn't that nice of a man. Is there anyone else across the ancient world who is known for being fantastic at what they do but aren't good people?
I have an interesting anecdote about this, actually. My tutor at university, Dr. Jakob Dahl, he would take massive offence if he discovered that other historians, other Assyriologists, might name their pets after Mesopotamian kings like Sargon or Nebuchadnezzar or Ashurbanipal or something like that. He said it was akin to naming your pets Hitler or Stalin or something. Because yes, whilst the annals hold these people up as sort of great rulers, in reality they would also have been massive despots at the apex of a hugely imbalanced hierarchical society. So that was something he was never particularly impressed by, this nostalgia for great kings as good men, just because they are powerful kings.
It's like the distance of time makes us more affectionate towards people. Like, we're all aware of how people dress up as pirates for fancy dress costumes. And pirates weren't exactly the shimmering beacon of moral high ground, because they were pirates. But also people dressing up as you know, the dandy highwayman who killed people. We have an affection, I think, that grows over time once we have a distance to things that people have done.
Yeah, Flo, it's also an affection for Matthew Bainton, the highwayman.
Listen, my thing for Matthew Bainton will never die. Anyway, Senya, have you got anybody from the ancient world who was great but not good?
some people call Constantine great. And I think that's because he was the first Roman emperor to convert to Christianity. And obviously then, subsequently, Christianity became the dominant religion of Europe. However, he was a totally horrible person. Like, even though he was a Christian, even when he was a Christian, he didn't really live by very many sort of Christian principles. He murdered his own son and his wife and, like, engaged in a whole load of very, very bloody wars. So, yeah, he's a tricky person. But I think we kind of, sort of my view on this is we do have to treat that holistically. We can't sort of ignore the difficulties of studying a particular character. But equally, I think it's important still to do so, because as Meg said, like, they've done cool things that they deserve to be studied for, perhaps even respected.
I'm going to lead on from so-called great or good men. Somebody with the username "So They Killed Socrates" has commented saying that philosophers were revered wise men in classical Greece. So much retconning. So I agree with this, because I have learned about things that ancient Greek philosophers have come out with, and one thing that sticks in my head is Plato deciding that men are featherless bipeds, humans are featherless bipeds, in his quest to categorize all animal life. So Diogenes, another philosopher, hand-delivered Plato a plucked chicken and went, "That's a man, because it is a featherless biped." And Plato was like, well, that's because men are featherless bipeds with broad, flat nails. And I think that this is kind of a good example that philosophers aren't super wise all the time. I can't remember who it was who said that plants eat soil to grow, or who it was who thought that he'd be cured from encephalitis by covering himself in dung and then died in the hot sun, or who it was who was in a barrel. Who was in a barrel? Somebody was in a barrel.
That was also Diogenes, wasn't
also
it?
Diogenes. God. Absolute legend.
I think, was Diogenes the same guy who used to just take a dump in theatres and pee on people because he didn't like them?
I don't know if he took a dump in theatres. He might well have been, you know, very much an outside toilet user. The whole barrel thing is, you know, he was living his life on his own terms. I think you're absolutely right, Flo. This they were all mad, basically. That's the sort of perception, that philosophers are sort of totally nuts, just doing their own thing. And then occasionally they hit on something really, really, really clever, and they, you know, they discover kind of atomic theory or something. But most of the time they're just totally spouting off.
I quite like the concept of being a philosopher in the ancient world, where you can just come up with utter nonsense, and then once a blue moon you hit on something, probably by chance. And with Nail and I, they say even a stop clock tells the right time twice a day. So if you're spouting, if you've got enough monkeys and enough typewriters, at some point you're going to say something really legit, and people are going to be like, it's going to be like watching M. Night Shyamalan films, where, yeah, okay, most of the films are really bad, but he did make Signs, so you have to just wait until something good comes along for you to tolerate the rest of his films, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Michael has chimed in to say that a misconception that annoys him is that democracy was the preferred and prevalent form of government in ancient Greece. And as a second part to that, that a united, homogenous Greek culture and society existed. You've touched on Greek culture before being a mix of different cultures, and also, we were talking about time earlier, you know, there's a large time span that covers. But what are your thoughts on the democracy part of that in ancient Greece?
Yeah, I mean, again, like, ancient Greece, it is a useful term, but it's also not a useful term. There's so many different systems of government, of rule, in the place that we call ancient Greece, in the time period that, like, ancient Greece refers to. There's actually loads and loads of different city-states, and they're all doing different things. And even within a city-state, so let's say Athens, which is obviously, like, your classic, your go-to city-state, they early on had a monarchy system with kings, and then they had an oligarchy, so, like, the rule of a few rich and powerful people, and then tyranny, which we talked about before, with the tyrannicides overthrowing single rulers. And again, tyranny in ancient Greece doesn't quite have the associations we would say, like, today. They don't have to be evil in ancient Greece. It's not like a tyrant in that sense, but it's one person ruling and often taking power by force. And then we do have democracy for a bit. Athens has nearly 200, 180 years, I think, of democracy, with a couple of brief interruptions. So that's pretty good. And then no more democracy anymore. So that's actually 180 years in the whole span of even just ancient Athenian history. So that's actually very, very little democracy. They had kings, rulers, tyrants for hundreds of years before that. So yeah, great point from that person.
So so we've talked about democracy not necessarily being the preferred and prevalent form of government in ancient Greece. I'm gonna expand that question to the rest of the ancient world. I know that when I was at primary school, there was a sort of a bit of a conflation of emperors and kings in ancient Rome. But I think, Zenya, you've touched on that previously, haven't you?
Absolutely. Big no-no. Yeah, so they started out with kings. And then they got rid of the kings and had a republic system, which again went through so many different iterations. And then they had emperors pretty much right up until the end. But I think because people call it the Roman Empire, you kind of associate that with an emperor. But actually, Rome was an empire without an emperor for quite a long time. It worked as a republic and an empire. For a huge chunk of its history. And even through the kind of process of evolving the system of the Republic, you get different kind of levels of rule. Sometimes you get temporary dictators installed, sometimes you get consuls, sometimes you get also, you know, different levels of representation being introduced.
Well, there we go. Right, so... I mean, I'm irked, quite frankly. I've now got secondhand annoyance from misconceptions in the ancient world. I think the gavel's probably got the most exercise it's got all summer. And I want to know what people's favourite things are. Meg, I'm going to start with you. What's your favourite thing that we've talked about today?
I think my favourite thing is actually quite a broad thing, which is this concept of sort of history within history. But I actually really liked Xenia's final point there about like the movement from the Republic to the Empire in Rome. And I think my understanding of that, having studied some of it at uni, is just that it represents such a massive split for the Romans. They're so preoccupied by the loss of the Republic. So they were really experiencing that history within history that we've been talking about. So I think that's a really good explanation of that. So that's my favourite thing.
Lovely. Yeah, I agree. It was really fascinating to me too. Xenia, what was your favourite thing that you've learned today?
I think my favourite thing was King Nabonidus and how he really wanted to sort of appreciate his own history. Because that, for me, sort of coming from the Roman perspective, I'm like, oh, wait, hang on, the Babylonians also had their own perception of their history. That feels like such a long time from, you know, the ADs. So yeah, I love that.
Fab. So we're going to go over to number one Nabonidus fan, Barney. What was your favourite thing that you've learned today?
It was part of the discussion of Alexander the Good, or Great. And it was Xenia's point about Constantine, actually. I really liked her observation that, you know, historically he's seen as good for converting the Roman Empire to Christianity, but himself didn't really exemplify the role of good Christian. I think that's a very interesting point from Xenia there, and I enjoyed hearing about it.
I did too, immensely. I think my favourite thing has to be just as absolutely taking a dump on Diogenes as a as a wise and revered philosopher, just as he probably took dumps as and when he wanted to because he was a little bit mad. I just like the idea that that people were like the great philosophers of the ancient world and actually they're just spilling a bit of water and then having a good idea and then for the rest of the time they're just in a barrel naked doing all sorts of things that aren't quite safe for this podcast, you know? I just like that as a concept. I'm going to go have a bath and see if I can come up with something really philosophical and smart and hope that people ignore the rest of my absolutely nutty things that I have to offer the world. So that's it for today's episode. Thanks for everyone's contributions. It definitely gave us food for thought. And I'm going to hope that I can duct tape the gavel back together after this episode.
Thank you ever so much for joining us for season 4 of Against the Law. Keep an eye peeled for some upcoming Twitter polls, which is only appropriate after today's episode. You can find us on Twitter. We are @AgainstLaw. Again, that's @AgainstLaw to share your thoughts, opinions and customer feedback. Also listen out for a Betwixt Season mini-series. It's one we've been hatching for a while and we're really excited to share our bundle of joy with you. Join us next time for Against the Law.